Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 18th of September. Our guest this hour is the author of The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class 1900 to 1970. Sam Pizzagatti writes about how the United States, which was really comparable to today in so many ways, a very unequal society, by the 20th century became one of the most equal nations in the whole wide world. Sam is a veteran labor journalist. He's written widely on economic inequality. His op-eds and articles on income and wealth have appeared in many papers, including the New York Times, Miami Herald. He ran the publishing operations of the National Education Association for 20 years and is now an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. He has a weekly online writing, Too Much, that is the name of the online writing that he does, and he does other writing as well. We're welcoming phone calls for Sam. We spent a lot of time the last hour talking about what has happened in the last 5 years. To this hour of the program, what's happened in the last over 100 years when it comes to income inequality and to the golden time when things were not so. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Sam. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah. Well, let's start with your childhood, if you don't mind. You talk about growing up in the 50s on Long Island, right in the middle of the new America that a victory over plutocracy created, and you took America's new middle class for granted. What was the new middle class? What did you take for granted?
Well, I actually grew up right next to Levittown, essentially right next door. And Levittown, of course, was the prototypical American suburb of the early post-war period. And I could ride my bicycle when I was a little kid on Long Island as far as I could go in any direction. And I would see no mansions and no hovels. Everything was sort of a standard middle-class house. And I thought that that was the way of the eternal way of the world. And I think people like me tended to take that equality that we grew up amid in the middle of the 20th century for granted.
Mm-hmm. Compare the two times, as you do early in the book, in terms of who was making money, who wasn't making money, the time before the Great Depression, which is incredibly similar to now, isn't it?
Yes, statistically and politically and culturally, the similarities between the early 1900s and these early years of the 21st century, the two epochs are almost identical. Back in the early 1900s, the richest 1% of American society were taking in essentially $1 out of every $4 in national income. Emmanuel Saez, the University of California at Berkeley economist, week before last released his latest income figures, and the top 1% in the United States is now taking home 23.5% of our national income. So essentially, we've come almost complete circle.
Mm-hmm. And what happened long about the time of the first Great Depression or a little before that got everybody worried about this? What was it?
Well, I think what we saw climaxing in the 1920s, we saw wealth concentrating at such a ferocious rate in the United States that essentially average working people had very little purchasing power without going into debt to get life's necessities. And that laid the basis. That ushered in essentially the Great Depression. And that's essentially the same story at the beginning of the 21st century, that regular average working people don't have the purchasing power to buy the goods and services they need without going into debt. And we've had the Great Recession as a result.
Mm-hmm. What was the role of, and you hate to see economic output go up because of war, but it is true, and you reference this in the book, that World War One and World War Two both had the effect of getting people more jobs and perhaps a bigger paycheck, that there was a huge effort to fund the war effort.
Yes, both of the world wars had a quote positive effect on employment and a positive effect on wage rates. But I think we need to keep in mind the long years of organizing to form unions that came before these two world wars. And because of that organizing, working people were able to take advantage of the special emergency conditions that the war created. If we can contrast World War II with the early years of the 2000s, we see a striking contrast, because that trade union bedrock, we don't have that now. And as a result, we've had enormous defense military spending over the last dozen years. And that spending has gone hand in glove with shrinking wages for average workers in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And tell this story through some of the individuals you reference in your book, or however you'd like to tell it. But that movement to get a fair wage for working people, the strikes, the organization of unions, it was done at great cost, great personal cost to a lot of people. It was a struggle. It was a violent struggle at times.
Yes, it was awful, often a violent struggle. People died striking, fighting for the right to collective bargaining. And people sacrificed a great deal. In 1946, which was the greatest strike year in American history, one out of every 10 workers in the United States went out on strike. That's a phenomenally high rate, and that sort of struggle set the stage for the mass equality that was to come in the early post-war decades.
Mm-hmm. And what about taxation policy? It's always interesting to look at this. It's a fascinating history, and I'm interested in what moved us to a point, and when this happened, when we were taxing people who are very wealthy at a much higher level than we are now. Give us a thumbnail sketch of this, please.
Yes. Well, we're actually just about coming upon the 100th anniversary of the federal income tax. Woodrow Wilson signed the federal income tax into effect on October 3rd, 1913. And at that time, the top rate of the income tax, the top marginal rate, was only 7%, very, very small. By World War II, the top rate had shot all the way up to 94% on income over $200,000. And that top rate would hover around the 90% for the next two decades. Throughout the Eisenhower years, Dwight Eisenhower, remember, was a Republican president. Throughout the Eisenhower years in the 1950s, the top tax rate was 91% on income over $400,000. Mm.
And $400,000 today, or then, would be comparable to what today?
About $3 million, $3.5 million today.
And was there a big battle to accomplish that? It's interesting that you had Republicans who agreed with this, as well as more progressive voices.
That's right. There was a huge battle, but it was not a one-sided battle. It was a bipartisan battle. There were Republicans who supported high progressive rates, and in fact, Dwight Eisenhower himself, we remember him now for his farewell speech that warned against the military-industrial complex, mm-hmm, right before he left office in 1961. Well, in the fall of 1960, Dwight Eisenhower went to Detroit to speak to the auto executives of the auto industry, and he warned against any tax system that failed to tax the very rich at a very high rate.
And then things changed with the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Is that what your analysis would say?
Well, actually, things started changing with the presidency of John F. Kennedy, the Democrat in the 1960s. The Kennedy administration stopped talking about the distribution of income and wealth in the United States, and it essentially just talked about growth. and said that if we grow the economic pie big enough, then everybody will have a bigger slice, and it doesn't matter how the pie is cut, how the pie is distributed. Kennedy famously said, a rising tide lifts all boats.
Mm-hmm.
And the first serious tax reduction in the United States for the rich happened under John F. Kennedy. The top rate went from 91% to 70% in 1964. 20 years later, 1981, Ronald Reagan would use the same rhetoric that came out of the Kennedy White House to justify his tax cuts, which by 1986, which would bring the top rate all the way down to 28%.
And how did President Kennedy intend to, he wasn't in office that long, but how did he intend to, and what policies did he put in place to grow the economic pie?
Well, his assumption was that if we had lower taxes on the wealthy, they would invest more money and the economy would grow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same. That's the same philosophy. That's the same approach that that conservatives today are taking. And what we've seen over the past 30 years that trickle down approach doesn't work. If we want to build a society, we need to do what the progressives of the early 20th century understood. We need to do two things. We need to level up the bottom and level down the top and create a society based on a giant middle class. If we do that, we're paving the ground for prosperity.
And who were those progressives, Sam, that obviously had their voices heard by a lot of people? Who was influential?
Well, there were a lot of different people, and they came from different walks of life. So, for instance, you had Louis Brandeis. Louis Brandeis, 100 years ago, was the most successful commercial lawyer in the United States. Around 1900, he was making $50,000 a year, when the typical successful lawyer was making $5,000 a year. And Brandeis said, we can either have a democracy in the United States or we can have great wealth concentrated in the pockets of a few, but we can't have both. And he devoted his entire public career, and he ended up as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, to that struggle for a more equal United States. So you had people like Louis Brandeis. You had people like Edward Filene, who was the great retail genius out of Boston, who founded the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And he was also, in his public life and pronouncements, committed to that struggle for a more equal United States, a United States that levels up the bottom and levels down the top. And two figures like Filene and Brandeis, we have an enormous range of working people who are active in the trade union movement. People like Walter Reuther, the great auto worker leader. So it was a multi-class effort to create this more equal United States. And there's a very strong consensus by the 1940s that we had to attack our inequality. Mm. And if we didn't attack our inequality, we weren't going to go anyplace decent.
Mm-hmm. I know that I have read recently in a book about Woodrow Wilson that Louis Brandeis was instrumental in fashioning a lot of Wilson's platforms with his ideas during his administration. So could you also say then that Woodrow Wilson would have been an endorser of equality?
Yes, he was. Woodrow Wilson was a very enterprising politician, and I think he saw the writing on the wall. And if he wanted to go far in American political life, he was going to have to get in step with people like Louis Brandeis. And he, and to his credit, he did. And the first Wilson administration was a period of substantial social reform, including the enactment of that first income tax.
Mm-hmm. And spend a little more time before we go to phone calls talking about the era right before equality emerged, and it was a long struggle for that to happen. But we spent the last hour talking about Wall Street and how trying to regulate Wall Street has not really resulted in much regulation, and those who are at the very top are still at the very top, and they're making enormous amounts of money. And We seem to be catering with our policies toward making sure that they're okay, that the system doesn't collapse because it's too big to collapse. Can you make comparisons in terms of the people who were kind of running the show? Was it another group of Wall Street bankers?
Yes, it was. Top financiers, exemplified by people like J.P. Morgan, whose name, of course, resounds today in the J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley companies. And we also had the great industrialists of the early 20th century, people like John D. Rockefeller, the original Rockefeller. So we had these very powerful industrial and financial figures, and they ruled over a desperately poor society. And I think we need to keep in mind that before the 1940s, two-thirds of the American people were poor. And what do we mean by that? We mean that two-thirds of the families in the United States never took vacations, never could feel comfortable about taking their kids to the doctor if they had a routine illness, never could dream about sending their kids to college, had no secure retirement to look forward to. All those basics of middle-class life were absent for two-thirds of the American people before the 1940s. And in that 20-year period, right, starting in the 1940s, we went from a society that was two-thirds poor to a society that was two-thirds middle class. That was a tremendous, tremendous achievement.
We welcome phone calls for our guest. He's the author of The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, 1900 to 1970. Sam Pizzagatti is our guest. Sam has written on economic inequality in many places, lots of newspaper magazines, and also he is the author of Greed and Good, Understanding and Overcoming the Inequality That Limits Our Lives. He is a associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and he edits Too Much, an online weekly on excess and inequality. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page, if you'd like to go that route, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. Here's an email that's come in, Sam, from Gary in Iron River. When the high tax rates were in effect during the Eisenhower years, there were a great deal more ways to reduce your taxable income than now. Could you address this to make the comparisons more relevant and accurate? All of the tax rate lowering bills closed loopholes and other deduction schemes.
Well, yes, there were, of course, loopholes. And when I talked about that 91% top rate, I was talking about the statutory top rate that applied to income in the top income bracket. But let's get down to what people actually paid and compared that to today. And we have lots of figures from the Internal Revenue Service. Let's look at the 400 richest Americans. In 1955, which was right in the middle of the Eisenhower years, the 400 highest reported incomes averaged just under $13 million. That's in today's dollars, after adjusting for inflation. Those people, those top 400 who averaged $13 million, paid 51.2% of their total incomes in federal income tax. So that, in other words, after exploiting every loophole they could find, the 400 richest in 1955 paid 51.2% of their incomes in federal income tax. Now let's jump up to 2007, which was the last year before the Great Recession. In 2007, the 400 richest Americans averaged, this is an average, $345 million each. That was their average income. And on that average income, after exploiting every loophole they could find, they paid federal taxes at a 6% rate. Mm. So in other words, after loopholes in 1955, the richest paid 51.2%. After loopholes in 2007, they paid 16.6% on incomes that were much, much, much higher.
Yeah, that's a lot of money, $345 million. You also make this comparison, which I think is an interesting one, between George Romney and his son Mitt Romney, just in terms of what CEOs of huge companies, American Motors, were making back in his father's time, and compare it with hedge fund business and this financial business that nobody knows exactly what you're doing for a living. But the difference in salary was enormous.
Well, it's essentially Mitt Romney took home more money in 1 year than his father took home in his entire career.
Mm. Remarkable. Keith in Dodgeville, hi.
Thank you. I've been trying to imagine entering into this struggle to make things equal today with the amount of money and the mass media involved, and I was interested in having you compare the role of money and media back in between the 40s and 60s when you said this was successfully addressed before. If you could compare that in terms of the struggle to make things equal and what it might be like today.
Well, it's a very good question. We face a very powerful obstacle today, and that obstacle is the economic concentration of the media. Back earlier in the 20th century, both early in 20th century and the middle of 20th century, we had a much more diverse media. The media editorially was still conservative on the whole, but there were many strong voices for a more equal United States. So, for instance, I think a lot of people know about the Scripps-Howard newspaper chain, which mm-hmm. is one of the major chains in the United States. E.W. Scripps was a prominent egalitarian in the first third of the 20th century. And in fact, during World War I, he advocated for a 100% tax rate on income over $50,000. And income over $50,000 is several million dollars today. Early in the 20th century, the largest circulation weekly newspaper in the United States was a socialist newspaper, The Appeal to Reason. So back in the 20th century, there was lots of space for contrarian views, views that challenged the economic mainstream. Now that media mainstream is really dominated by giant corporations, so it's more difficult to get the word out. On the other hand, we do have this phenomenon called the Internet, which does provide an avenue for alternate voices. So I think there is reason for hope, and I think that just as our forebears conquered America's original plutocracy, I think we can prove victorious over the plutocracy that we have amid us today.
Why? What makes you think that?
Because I think that the obstacles that we face, when you add them all up, are no greater than the obstacles that people at the beginning of the 20th century faced. It took them a generation to beat back plutocracy, and it's going to take us a long time as well.
Keith, thanks for your call. David is next in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I appreciate what your guest is saying about us kind of coming around full circle to where we were before the Great Depression. But I think in a lot of ways we're actually even further back than that. You know, and it wasn't until 1850 or so that people could vote who did not own land. You know, wage laborers were excluded from our representative government. And if you look at the words of the founding fathers, they actually, in many cases, didn't distinguish between wage laborers and slaves. Oliver Ellsworth in convention August 22nd, 1787, urged his colleagues not to intermeddle in the slave trade because, quote, as population increases, poor laborers will be so plenty as to render slaves useless. If you look at Thomas Jefferson's Notes on Debate on Confederation, Volume 1, 1827, he's remarking about an argument that John Adams made. And John Adams argued, what matters it whether a landlord employing 10 laborers on his farm give them annually as much money as will buy them the necessaries of life, or give them those necessaries at shorthand? 10 laborers add as much wealth annually to the state, increase its exports as much in the one case as the other. And John Taylor, a close associate of Thomas Jefferson, in his inquiry into the principles and policy of the government of the United States, 1814, pointed out that putting a laborer into debt is far more profitable than owning that laborer outright. And he saw the early American society as a class conflict between lenders and debtors. And he said one interest is a tyrant and the other a slave. And he wrote just two sentences here. In Britain, one of these interests owes to the other about 1,000 million pounds of sterling, which would require 12 million slaves to discharge at 80 pounds sterling each. If the debtor interest amounts to 10 millions of souls and would be worth 40 pounds sterling round sold for slaves, it pays 12.5% on its capitation value to the creditor interest.
Sam, let's get a response.
Well, I'm not quite sure what the question there is.
All right. Did you have a question, David, or? David? All right. Well, thanks for all the information. We appreciate it. Let's go to Bobby in Arcadia. Hi, Bobby.
Hi there. I've got kind of a two-part question, and it's, the first one is, I walked along with Christino during one of the state fairs when all the collective bargaining on a witch hunt was on, and I couldn't believe how many people making under $40,000, $30,000, $25,000 were being sucked in to the trickle-down economics, and they really thought that this was going to be the way to go. And I'm wondering if, through his research, if he has any understanding of why people in the lower income brackets would buy into this. And I'm wondering also, how bad does he think things are going to have to get this time before people start to rise up again and demand fair wages?
Good questions. Again, it's essentially, you know, how long are we going to put up with this ideology that says we need to keep feeding the top to help everybody else? I think this ideology is sounding more and more hollow in American society. We've gone now almost 40 years where average people in the United States have been on a constant economic treadmill, running every higher and running ever faster and not moving ahead in life, not gaining more security, and in fact becoming less secure economically. There have been a lot of distractions from the top to try to keep people from noticing what's been happening. But I think there's lots of polling data that shows that millennials, that is people, young people, today, people in their 20s and 30s really do not accept the tenets, the basic tenets of trickle down, and that polling data is very encouraging to see, because I think we can build movements upon that can challenge the intense maldistribution of income and wealth that we have in American society.
But the very thing that changed things substantially, or one of the large contributing factors, was the labor organization, the unionization of many American workers 100 years ago. Now you're seeing fewer and fewer workers being unionized, and as you know what happened in the state of Wisconsin, it's happened elsewhere, the strength of unions being just diminished completely.
Yes, so absolutely true. But let's keep in mind that, it, as the old saying puts it, it's always darkest before the dawn. So if you looked at the end of the 1920s, we had only 7% of American workers in unions, and that's about the same exact percentage of private sector workers we have in unions today in the United States. Yet back back in those late 1920s, within 10 years after those late 1920s, we had a vibrant labor movement in the United States. We had tens of millions of American working people joining unions. So things can turn around very, very rapidly. And what I saw from last week's AFL-CIO convention was a real commitment to turning things around, to recreating the labor movement in a way that that acknowledges the differing economic conditions that we have today.
Mm-hmm. All right, Bobby, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Kevin in Madison next. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, Kevin.
Hi. I'm curious of how, you know, there's a number of things here. You were talking that the tax rate got up to 90%, and then right before the war, all these jobs were created to, you know, by the government to fund the war. Well, those jobs aren't here right now. You know, there's no jobs for the government to create, and I'm curious of where those jobs are going to come from, as well as, you know, I think it was a different type of labor force back then. You know, people were willing to go out and do whatever they had to do to put food on the table, where now, you know, these, food stamp cards and unemployment have been lasting so long, there's a lack of incentive to go out, and almost a lack of, you know, almost pride to have to go out and get a job to put food on the table, where I believe that was much more predominant back then. And then, like you said, the unions came on so strong so quickly that it just it brought that middle class up so fast that it just shrunk the number of, brought the amount of money into that middle class so much more, so just equaled out. The percentage came up. The actual amount of money didn't come down, other than the fact that it was taking from taxes. So I guess where are the jobs going to come from that pay that type of money?
Well, during World War II, there was a great fear among some public policy analysts that once the war ended, we were going to sink into another depression. And we had economists arguing during World War II that we had all these jobs, we had all this employment, but it was all war-based employment. And once the war ended, you know, we were going to go to hell in a handbasket. But none of that happened. The war ended, lots of war jobs ended, but at the same time, we had a new middle class, a new emerging, rising, growing middle class with all sorts of needs, and supplying the needs of that middle class created millions of jobs, millions of good jobs. And created a prosperity that the United States had never seen before and has never seen since. And as I look around, today there's plenty of work that needs to be done. I mean, start with the decaying infrastructure mm-hmm. in the United States, the lack of sound bridges. You know, our trains are going slower on railroad tracks today than they did 100 years ago because of lack of maintenance. There's tremendous infrastructure that needs to be done. There are a tremendous number of jobs that could be created in schools by putting aides in every classroom to guarantee every child some adult, more regular adult contact. There's all sorts of valuable work that remains to be done in this society. We just need the will to create the jobs to do that, and we can create that will. We can create those jobs if we follow the course that Americans followed in the middle of the 20th century, and that is to share our income and wealth more equitably.
Thanks, Kevin, for your call. We'll take more in a moment. Our guest this hour is Sam Pizzagatti. His latest book is The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, 1900 to 1970. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. New research from Harvard Medical School shows mammograms may be helpful for women who are younger than 50, which contradicts information from the National Cancer Institute and other cancer groups. On Central Time at 3, Rob and Veronica will talk with a breast cancer radiologist about what's involved in a mammogram, and we'll break down this new research. All right, let's go back to phone calls for Sam and to Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, I'd like just to take a mild exception to your guest's commentary or implying that Woodrow Wilson was a progressive or in any way an egalitarian. Wilson, upon ascending the presidency, was a devout racist, and he reintroduced segregation throughout the federal government that had been somewhat alleviated by his predecessors, particularly Theodore Roosevelt.
I agree with the caller 100% on Wilson's racism. And in fact, the point I was making that he was not a genuine progressive, but that he was an enterprising politician and saw where the country was headed. And he raced as fast as he could on economic matters to catch up to the country. But he was a vile racist, a segregationist. He was also very prejudiced against Slavic and Southern European immigrants. He was not a wholesome character.
But he did nominate Louis Brandeis to the Supreme Court.
Yes, and that may have been his finest moment.
Let's go to Jim in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thank you. Wonderful program. The only thing that I hope you'll do is spell your name somewhere along the line so I get it right. I so appreciate your optimism. I have been thinking for quite a long time about a couple of things. That all of the progress of labor is an extension out of slavery, and we peaked somewhere in you know when better than I, but now we're slowly retracting toward toward slavery. It's just an incremental slide. That's one thing, and if you could comment on the concept of commonwealth, the way this, some parts of the country, states, Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where there was a notion of commonwealth, and I would sure appreciate listening to your comments on that. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
Well, there's a long tradition talking about exploitative industrial labor conditions as wage slavery. So the caller is quite correct to make that connection. Philosophers have been making that for a number of years. The other part of that question again was?
I think that's pretty much covered the substance of what he had to say. Thank you very much for the call. I'm sorry he left us. Dave in Wanakee. Hi, Dave.
Yes, hello. I'd like to your guest to comment on whether he's read Taxes and the Economy, an economic analysis of top tax rates since 1945 by Thomas Hungerford, which was commissioned by the Republican Congress but was suppressed by them because it didn't conform to their stated ideology that lowering the tax rates would increase growth, increase investment, increase productivity. On the contrary, what it showed was that the only thing correlation they could make was that it would aggregate wealth into the hands of the few instead of the many.
I've read of that, but I haven't actually read that that paper. But I certainly agree with that paper's general drift. This is a very inconvenient truth for conservatives in our society, and the truth is this: when tax rates on the rich have been at their highest over the past 100 years, the middle class flourished at its best, at its highest level. We had the healthiest economy. And when tax rates on the rich have been at the lowest, we have been at the most insecure economic times for average Americans. So conservatives for the past 100 years have been crying wolf. have been claiming that the economy will collapse if we tax rich people at stiff rates. But the actual unfolding of history has proven them wrong time and time again.
What did LBJ do with tax rates?
Well, LBJ followed JFK's K's policy, and after Kennedy was assassinated, the tax cut that the Kennedy administration proposed became law early in 1964 under Johnson's administration. Later in the 60s, Johnson actually increased the top tax rate to meet the expenses of the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Steve, very much for your call. We go to Tom in Nelson. Hello.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
After Reagan, why have the Republicans been so against tax increases? It seemed as though the floodgates seemed to have opened with Reagan. And the B question is there a possible racial undertone in that the poor are mainly Hispanic now and African American, and everybody thinks, well, they're lazy, they don't want to work, and tax the rich, we're just going to give money to those people that don't want to work and are on welfare, et cetera, et cetera. Someone mentioned earlier the food stamp thing and so on and so forth. Is there an underlying racial tone? I get that just from people I talk to around here on the street, you know, and I just wondered what your guest might say. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, excuse me. Yes, I think there is definitely a racial undertone to this, but I also believe that there doesn't have to be, and that people at the very rich at the top are so insulated from the lives that working people actually live on a daily basis, that these stereotypical attitudes are applied to all poor people, to all average working people, not just people of color. So when you look back at some of the things rich people were saying in the early years of the 20th century, in the early 1900s, they were saying incredible things about average people, about how lazy and shiftless they were. The rich were opposed at that time workmen's compensation legislation because they claimed that if you gave workers payments if they lost legs and arms in workplace accidents, that they would purposely go and cut off their legs.
Ooh.
Cut off a leg in order to collect the workers' compensation payment. I mean, it's just incredible when you read stuff like that.
Yeah, it is. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Cindy in Appleton, hi.
Hello. I'm going to reference the Koch brothers, ALEC, the Walton Foundation, the richest 1%. I would like to know, what do they have to gain if we become a third world country? I don't understand this race to the bottom.
I'm sorry, what do they have to gain?
What do they have to gain if for a race to the bottom, if we become a third world country?
What we have to gain as a country is nothing. What they have to gain is security for themselves and their and their fortunes. But back in the 1970s, we faced a choice in the United States about which way we were going to go. In the middle of the 20th century, most of our industrial competitors were devastated by World War II, and they were rebuilding, and we sort of ruled supreme in global economic markets. When Europe and Japan started recovering, we faced a choice where we were going to take the low road and try to compete by paying our workers less and squeezing as much as we could out of them, or were we going to take the high road to compete? And that is train our workers, try to become incredibly efficient and innovative in our enterprises. And essentially, corporate America chose to take the low road. And we've been struggling with the with the impact of that ever since. Other nations like Germany have taken, and Sweden have taken the high road. And they've said that if you want to compete globally, you compete by training your workers, by paying them well, by building workforces that are committed and innovative and enterprising. And we haven't taken that route.
You talk about, and again, excuse me, egalitarian triumph not being confined to the United States, but dominant middle classes emerging throughout the world during this time period, the mid-20th century, Japan, Canada, all other, all over Europe. Did the United States lead the way here?
Yes.
Was they were emulated yes. in other countries?
Yes. We led the way. We were the first nation in the history of the world in the middle of the 20th century where a majority of the people were not poor. The first nation in the history of the world with a mass middle class. Mm. And in fact, the last gasp of the New Deal in the United States was in Japan. In Japan after World War II, when the U.S. occupied Japan, the civilians who ran that occupation were all New Dealers. And they put in place in Japan essentially a New Deal that helped make Japan a much more equal and a much more prosperous nation.
Thank you very much, Cindy, for your call. Jim in West Allis, hi.
Hi. A couple of callers ago, there was a gentleman that made a comment about how people are not encouraged to work as hard anymore because of all these government benefits like the food stamp program. First of all, I'd like to make a comment. The average SNAP benefit, you know, that's food stamp benefit, is $133 a month. That's, you know, I know it varies state by state. That's about $4.50 a day. I defy anybody to try and feed themselves on $4.50 a day. Secondly, it is my understanding, and I wanted to check this with your guest, that most people who are receiving food stamp benefits are, in fact, working people. They're, the fact is their wages are so low they can't provide decent food for their families. Is that true?
Yes, I don't know the exact figures on that, but the food stamp program is a basic bulwark for working people who are making next to nothing on their job. It's how they can afford to put food on the table for their families. It's a very basic element of social decency in the United States.
We haven't talked very much about the public services. You write about the tax system and how it's changed and really pretty radically. But the tax system being able to provide the public services that enabled entry into America's new mass middle class. What were those services?
That's essentially, during the World War, during World War II, the United States and the rest of the world, tax rates went up to pay for the war. After World War II, tax rates on the rich stayed high. And because they stayed high, we were able to fund an explosion in all sorts of services. They range from the mundane things like the interstate highway system in the United States that was all built with money that our tax system supplied, to the explosion of higher education in the United States. I mean, before World War II, only upper middle class and upper class people, essentially families, sent their kids to college. That all changed after World War II in those 20 years. We had states like California, which guaranteed higher education to every high school graduate after World War II. Again, a tremendous egalitarian achievement.
Time for one more phone call, and it's Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, I want to bring up the phrase made in America and the global economy. For instance, today I need to get a broom, but I can't find a broom made in America at any nearby stores because maybe they had to pay the workers a living wage. So instead, this is what we've done in America. We've decided to have the broom made in China at slave wages, or India or Pakistan, or, you know, name any of those countries at slave wages, and we will actually spend more in transporting that object here than we used to pay for it wholesale. So we're spending, let's say, on a $5 broom, you're spending $4.50 to ship it here. And who's paying? The world, environment is who's paying the tab. And we are killing the oceans with all this shipping, and this is just mindless.
Sam.
Well, I think the caller makes an excellent point about the link between growing inequality and growing ecological degradation in the United States. The more that wealth and income concentrate, the more that our environment is at risk in all sorts of interesting ways. So those private jets that the super rich fly all around in are much more environmentally toxic than regular commercial air transportation, and there are all sorts of examples like that. So I think the caller is actually absolutely right. If we want to build a sustainable economy, it's got to be a more equal economy.
And thanks, Ray, for the call. Sam, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Sam Pizzigatti, you spell his last name P-I-Z-Z-I-G-A-T-I. The book is The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, 1900 to 1970. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this hour, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Good conversations ahead. And we'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.